we have as our next guest, Mr. Neil Howe, who is a brilliant man. He is an historian, economist, author, founding partner of the consulting firm Life Course Associates. He is a marketing, personnel, and government affairs consultant to corporate and nonprofit clients. He has spoken and written extensively on the collective personalities of today's generations, who they are, what motivates them, how they will shape America's future. He is also a recognized authority on global aging, long-term fiscal policy, and migration. His current titles include Public Policy Advisor to the Blackstone Group, Senior Advisor to Concord Coalition, and Senior Associate to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In just a moment, we will discuss with Mr. Neil Howe a book that has been read with a mixture of terror and excitement. And it says right here on the back of it, if Strauss and Howe are right, they will take their place among the great American prophets, and they're awfully, awfully close. In just a moment, Mr. Neil Howe on Coast to Coast AM. John B. Wells in for George Norrie tonight, and delighted to be here with Mr. Neil Howe. Neil, how you doing?
Just great, John. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. You've been at this for a while. Before we start, I just want to publicly express my condolences for the recent loss of your writing partner and friend, William Strauss.
Well, thank you very much. It's tough for us. He's been around. I've been writing with him for just over 20 years now. We started doing books together on generations in the late 1980s. And like, you know, a typical baby boomer like myself, we all had other careers. He was also the founder of the Capitol Steps, the political satire troupe, and organized a lot of theatrical and musical programs for teenagers across the country.
Well, he had an awfully good run, and his work endures.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's see. The copyright date, on Generations was 1991, and then 13th Generation, or 13th Gen, 1993, and it brings us up to the fourth turning, which is 1997.
97, that was just 10 years ago, and an interesting book. I should backtrack a little bit. Generations was our first book, and it was by far the book we worked the longest on. We basically retold the whole history of America from a very different perspective, the way it had never been told before. Most people, they write the history of the United States, they just write it, you know, it's mainly about people in midlife, the leaders and the parents, you know, what they do year after year. Occasionally you'll find a book about the history of childhood or the history of marriage or something, and it'll track some other age group. We decided to do something different. We wrote a book going back all the way to the 17th century that looked at each generation. That is to say, each group of kids that came along, how they were raised, what they first found out about life, how they came of age, how they went through marriage and courtship and so on, how they embarked on their careers or their callings, what kind of wars or what kind of spiritual awakenings they went through, how they exercised power in midlife, and then how they got old and how they saw younger generations behind them. And so what we did is we told the whole history of America as a series of these diagonals, kind of like tiles on a roof, as Émile Littré, one of the great European theorists on generations, used to say. You know, generations are like tiles on a roof, right? They overlap with each other. And what we found is amazing, because what we found is that each generation, each group of people born over a period of about 20 years or so, about the time it takes to, you know, from birth to coming of age as an adult, was completely different. And its attitudes and behaviors and its self-awareness. I mean, not just boomers and, you know, not just the people we see today, but this has been going back through history. And not only are they very different, but we found that these differences tended to recur in a certain kind of rhythm or pattern. And we identified basically four types of generations that, with few exceptions, and we're not historical determinists or anything like that, but in America, really only one exception, tended to recur in the same order, and that these recurrence of certain types of generations has given history itself in America a certain rhythm, a certain order. And in our original book, Generations, that came out in 1991, we told really as a history book. It's really the story of those generations, and it uses a lot, it cites a lot of social history and a lot of stuff that's only been around the last 20 or 30 years, not just the you know, history of wars and political leaders. So we did it that way, and we hinted at this cycle in American history toward the end of the book. So it's generations first, rhythm there that kind of implied a rhythm for history. The 13th Gen, which we did in 1993, was really a book on Generation X. So that was a different kind of book. It came out around the same time as Doug Kuplan wrote Generation X. But then in 1997, we did The Fourth Turning. And The Fourth Turning took generations and it turned it around. Instead of starting with generations, we started with the whole concept of rhythms of history. Does history have a pattern? Is it just random? Is it just chaotic? Is it linear? Or is it linear up or linear down, as some people like to say? Or is it a rhythm? Or is it a rhythm with direction over time, maybe like a spiral? Well, we took the rhythmic part of it, and we tried to show how so many of the rhythms that people have seen, not only in America but many societies around the world, rhythms of times of, you know, of great outer world crisis and great inner world rebuilding, rhythms in culture, drugs, family life, experimentation, risk-taking, culture and family solidarity and family dissolution, how these things really coincided with a cycle of generational change. And so what we did is we started with this idea and explored, as what many historians have talked about, rhythms of history, and we explained it through a sequence of these generational types. And one of the conclusions in this book is that sometime during this decade, before the end of this decade, or you know maybe shortly into the next, but right around now, society would enter into what we call the fourth turning, there being four basic moods or eras to American history. And this fourth turning was a time of outer world crisis, a time of rebuilding of economic and social and particularly political institutions, typically a time when we sort of redefine who we are as an empire or a republic. And it would be a time of great public urgency. And we came out with that book in 1997. We said it's going to happen sometime in the next decade. And then, of course, 9/11 came along. And I remember it was about 3 weeks after 9/11, and I think I went on C-SPAN right about 6 o'clock at rush hour. I can remember the mood of America about 3 weeks after 9/11. It was something else. And then I went on there, and they gave me about 20 minutes, and they sort of put the whole book up on charts on the screen. And our book went right to the top of Amazon and stayed there for several weeks. A book that had already been in print for about three or four years. It's kind of an interesting history to this book. It gives a lot of insights into our method, and I must say that's not all we do is just look for rhythms of history. We spend a lot of time, too, looking at each of these individual generations, who they really are and how they're expected to change as they grow older. And I must say most of our work for businesses and so on has to do with looking in depth at these generations, at their attitudes and behaviors. But I love a show like this where we can also look a little bit at the bigger pattern, the bigger picture.
Well, this is very interesting. Now, let me ask you this. These rhythms that you've identified, you're an economist, and as an economist, as well as a historian, you look at trends. And so these trends that you've described in your books are uniquely American. Well, let me ask you this. If these rhythms are different from those in other countries...
They're not uniquely American. And I will say that recently, in the last few years, we've been asked, not just by, intelligence agencies here. I'm in the greater D.C. area, and so that's easier for me to do, particularly when asked to look at generations overseas, abroad. But when we look at history of other countries, particularly European history and China, East Asian history, as well as long eras of our common classical history, we see many of these same patterns, and we see many of these same generational archetypes alternating with each other. So this is not unique to America. We think that it's particularly striking in America because we've had a history that, you know, as Tocqueville said in the 1830s, in America, every generation is born new, right, has the freedom to sort of reshape institutions according to its temperament, its mood. And that's given America a striking variety of generational change. And Tocqueville noticed this in the early 19th century when most of Europe still had, you know, established religions and strongly organized, you know, class differences and so forth. I think America was where it first became most visible, but I think every modern society shows these basic changes, and they've come up often in history as well, in times of stress and change. So I don't think it's unique. I will say that most economists are analysts. You know, they just look at the short term. You know, they look at all the bits and pieces and try to see if they can, you know, add it all up into something that makes sense as a whole. There has been always a semi-submerged tradition among economists and economic thinkers who try to look at these long rhythms. One was a man who's become very famous, was Nikolai Kondratiev, who actually died in Stalin's gulag back in the 1930s. I don't think he survived the purges of the 30s. But he actually had the opinion that capitalist economies had this long Kondratiev wave, and that gave birth to the whole notion of the cave wave, which is long-term rhythms in our economy. And we think there are long-term rhythms in the economy, as there are in social and political change, which beat to the rhythm of generational change.
So you've actually been able. So basically, you've been able to observe that these four turnings occur in different countries and different cultures. They just start and stop at different times.
Yes, and then interrupted more. Again, we're not determinists. We don't say that this trumps everything. Sometimes great disasters occur, and sometimes other things can intervene. Particularly, other countries can intervene, and so forth. Things can go better or worse than expected. I think that American history is a very clear-cut example. Think of the following fact, that the great kind of secular crises in American history, and going back to our colonial history, think of the Glorious Revolution, you know, that huge change in the British Empire that occurred in the late 1680s and 90s with a huge global war that we were engaged in. And then about 90 years later, we had the American Revolution. And then about 90 years later, we had the Civil War, and then about 90 years later we had World War II, you know, the Great Depression, the New Deal, and World War II. We have the certain rhythm in these periods of extreme crisis, not just crises in terms of a lot of people die or a lot of people dislocated, but complete redefinition of how we think of ourselves politically, of a nation and empire, and to some extent a reconstruction of our political institutions. And then roughly halfway in between those times, we've had the great awakenings of religion and culture in our country. In fact, the late 1960s and 1970s, by some historians, is called the fourth or fifth great awakening in America. You know, going back to John Winthrop in the 1630s or Jonathan Edward in the 1740s, depending on when you want to start your count. But we had the, you know, second Great Awakening in the 19th century, and then the third Great Awakening right around 1900, and we've had the Consciousness Revolution, and each of those events, which was a sea change in the culture, and here's a clue. Think about the fact that whenever we talk about political change in America, we say since World War II, but whenever we talk about culture in America, we say since the 60s. In other words, these are events. One resets the clock in politics in the outer world. The other kind of event resets the clock in our history when it comes to culture, values, in the inner world. And this, again, is driven by generational changes.
Was our cultural revolution that began to occur in the 60s, was that aided and abetted by what was going on in England at the time? Because it seemed like they had a pretty profound influence, and it would seem to suggest some sort of a global rhythm, or have I jumped over the guardrail?
In France they had the 68, in Paris they had the 68, in Germany, and in France they call them les 68 heures, you know, the 68ers. In Germany, the 68er, you know, the 68, and they're considered idealistic, utopian, hippie-ish midlife people by younger Europeans today. The Chinese had the Red Guard generation, who came of age in the Cultural Revolution, which is taking place at the same time. We do have a certain overlap in these periods, and that's something we can, you know, look at if you want a little bit more closely. It's a fascinating subject.
Well, so Was there a moment of truth when you and William went, well, good grief, look at this.
We were not originally expecting to discover a cycle or a rhythm in generations. It hit us. We were actually originally simply going to write a book about how generations leave certain endowments for you know, those who were left after them. We thought that was kind of a mystery, kind of an interesting subject. But the more we looked at these generations, the more we saw repeating tendencies. We saw the same kind of generations reappear in their location in history, and the lessons they learn, and in the reputation they leave behind. And that absolutely fascinated us. And once we saw that, we just couldn't let it go.
Beyond something that we can track, Neil, and analyze and quantify, what's the meaning of this? What does this suggest for humankind? Let alone the United States or this culture or that country. Is there something else going on here?
Well, generations correct for each other. That's why every generation is different. Every generation turns a corner on the one that comes before it. And this is the first rule of generations. It's never a continuation. It turns a corner. And this is necessary to keep civilization from going off the cliff. I mean, imagine if generations followed each other linearly. Imagine you had, you know, thousands of years ago, a boomer-like generation, then more boomer after that, and more boomer after that. You can, you know, see where that would have gone, right? That wouldn't have gone
exactly.
That far. There has to be a process of correction, of compensation. And we see that all the time. And generations are a natural response to that. And these turnings of history, these changes in our national mood, reflect these generational changes as they layer on top of each other. And they, too, correct for excesses. We veer too far into the direction of exploring our inner self. We're jolted out of that. We veer too far in the direction of reconstructing our outer world, and we're jolted out of that. And it's interesting to one thing we can talk a little bit about is how these, you know, what these turnings are and how they follow each other and sort of how they're driven by generational changes.
Very good. And I would also like to explore with you, is there a parallel experience occurring now with any other really major players? It looks to me like, for example, China, I don't know if they're experiencing their high or their awakening at this point.
Well, China is a country now of tremendous confidence, tremendous activity. Most boomer and Xer age Chinese believe that their country is going to, inherit the earth, if not in their lifetime, in the lifetime of their kids. And you look at the kids now, they're all behind gates, they're all dressed in uniforms, they're busy and programmed all the time, a little bit like a lot of our kids today, leading, you know, heavily supervised and programmed lives. Confucius is being brought back now in China to raise the kids, you know, the Red Guard generation, who got rid of every vestige of Confucius, right, back in the 1970s, is now bringing it back so they can raise their own kids to be deferent to their elders.
Well, let's go into that a little bit more deeply. We're speaking with Neil Howe, a rational man, an analyst, an economist, a historian, and a very interesting guy. I'm John B. Wells, in for Mr. George Norrie tonight. We'll be back in a minute. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're talking with Neil Howe about some real heavy stuff. And what I would like to do, even though I know that our audience has just sat through a break, but I'll tell you what I would really like to do. I would like to go into our next break as quickly as possible so that we can have a nice long run of it because... Well, Neil doesn't have any real short answers. They're very, very, they're very detailed, and they're very much worth hearing. So I would like to do that. And when we come back, I would like to discuss with him, what about the people that fall outside of these year parameters and the fact that in this culture, we make 5-year plans, we make 10-year plans, we don't make 50-year plans or 100-year plans like our friends, the Chinese. Why don't we discuss that with Neil when we come back on Coast to Coast AM? All right, we are back. Neil, let me ask you a question. And if I go off the rails or out to lunch, just give me one of those you don't understand my work at all, you know, one of those deals. But how much of this turning that we're going to get into much more deeply is caused by, if it something is causing it, is it caused by a lack of planning as a culture? I mean, I seem to recall a biblical admonition to work as though we were preparing an inheritance for our great-grandchildren, which is sort of sounds like the Chinese are hep to that one. Where are we in this regard?
It's partly because we don't plan for the future. It's also, it's also simply that we respond to problems differently depending upon our mood. Sometimes we respond to threats and problems by putting them off, deferring, compromising, delaying, procrastinating. And other times in our history, we say, wait a second, this is it. We're going to solve it all now. And as long as we're solving this, we're going to solve that and that and that. And I think that this gets a little bit to the other question you ask, why is it that we sometimes think really long-term in our public life when sometimes we couldn't care less? We pile up the liabilities. We have these unfunded pension plans, both in the private sector and the public sector, where no one cares about whether we can ever afford these things. And then suddenly we hone in. Look at the 1930s and early 1940s. And this really, when you talk about the GI generation, right, that generation, they poured more concrete. They built more dams. They built the interstates. They straightened the rivers. They did all the stuff that lasted for 100 years. They designed the New Deal, the Social Security system, all of these acronym agencies in Washington, which are still around, doling out subsidies, organizing markets, planning communities. They did that, and they did it so well that by the time we boomers came around, we thought they overdid it, right?
Yes.
It's time to think about now. It's time to enjoy life. I mean, what's the point of all this? And that's the point, really. It's a question of generational learning and generational forgetting. Let me go back just a second and talk a little bit, just say a little bit about these generations. You're talking in the abstract. Let's put some players into these roles here, and talk about today's living generations. We have five of them today, maybe even six, but we certainly have five. The GI generation, and we all know, Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, right? And I don't know. I'm sure a lot of the listeners heard, seen Ken Burns' special, right, The War. That's the story of that generation and how they started out. And what's amazing about the GIs is how, when they were kids, they were raised by protective communities and parents who fussed over them and wanted them to be as good as the previous generation of kids were wild and bad. They later became known as the Lost Generation, high rates of murder and juvenile delinquency and risk-taking and no improvement in education. These GIs were straight arrows. And for the first time in our history, we had uniformed youth clubs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Campfire Girls. We had child labor laws and prohibitions against alcohol and drugs for kids. And early on, they got this reputation as straight arrows. These were the first Miss Americas. They got their first jobs with government when the Great Depression hit. They were the CCC dam builders and tree planters. They were the heroes of Iwo Jima and World War II. They were the most uniformed generation per capita in American history. And they were regarded as good kids, really civic-minded kids. They voted more often than older people back during the New Deal. And when they came off from the war, they just kept on building, right? The
yes.
States and the miracle vaccines and the Great Society, Apollo moon launch, all the things they built. And they got into arguments with boomers born after the war, just didn't understand the moral purpose of making all these institutions bigger and stronger all the time. But my point is the GIs started out as junior citizens. Everyone considered them junior citizens. And when they entered old age, hit the age of 1965, right around the year, they hit the age 65 right around the year 1965. Remember, John Kennedy called this, generation born in this century is how he defined his peers. We invented a new word to describe old people. We called them senior citizens, right? We never called old people senior citizens before then. We just called them old people.
That's right.
And retirement was something you did with a used-up machine. Now it was public reward for a lifetime of good public deeds. So they redefined every phase of life they went through. The next generation we call the silent generation. We define them as born between 1925 and 1942. These were the children of the World War II and the Great Depression. They were the They were the kids who were heavily sheltered while older people were making all these sacrifices on their behalf. And when they came of age, right after World War II, they surprised older people because, unlike the GIs, they didn't want to do these big heroic things with government. They didn't join the Communist Party. They didn't want to conquer half the world. Their watchword was on college campuses, we don't want to change the system. We want to work within the system. And Fortune magazine had a cover story in 1949 called The College Class of 49, Taking No Chances. That was the subtitle at the bottom of the cover. And their first questions in job interviews were about pension plans. They got the name Silent, and this is the historian William Manchester actually gave them this label, during the early 50s because they kept their heads down during the McCarthy era. They didn't say anything. They didn't want anything to go on their permanent records. And so they had these very well-planned careers. They got married incredibly young. They made these decisions very young. They've done very well in the economy all their life. They've been heavily insured. They've been the generation that, you know, the last 10 years have been getting their golden parachutes, and they've all got these defined benefit pension plans and so forth. And they're small in number. You know, Woody Allen says 80% of life is just showing up, and this is his, you know, his silent generation. And they kind of checked in and checked out. They've had an awkward personal life. This is the generation that triggered the divorce revolution in midlife when they were in the 70s. You know, that all that early marriage, I think, caught up with them.
Isn't this sort of tantamount to just riding a really nice wave?
No, it is. And the demographer, Richard Easterlin, calls them the fortunate generation. You know, they're small in numbers. We won't have to cut Social Security or Medicare on their watch. Of course, we boomers know what's coming. So you got that generation. And very interestingly, this generation has a reputation for process and committees. And, you know, we sometimes make fun of them as the Jim Lehrer NewsHour generation. You know, they've always got these people with all the credentials and the complex phraseology. They probably will become the first generation in American history never to enter the White House. Think about it. We've totally leapfrogged this generation. Also, for the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, they've also been leapfrogged. We've gone from a GI to a boomer. Interesting.
It really is.
And then you have boomers, right? Now, we define boomers born from 1943, so that's the Mario Savio free speech class of 1964 when they got to college.
Right.
And we define them all the way to 1960, not to 1964, but born to 1960. And these were the, you know, increasingly indulged kids, right, born after the war, the feed-on-demand Dr. Spock babies and the Beaver Cleavers of the 50s and the screaming radicals and, well, you know the whole story. What, you know, boomers like ourselves, we know the story. No phase of life means anything until we boomers have experienced it and can tell other generations all about it, right? I mean, that's kind of our story. And a couple of things about boomers is their individualism, their sense of self-sufficiency. We really don't need institutions. We rejected them. Even a great sense of gender self-sufficiency. This is the first generation of women who feel they can just start their own careers and don't have to depend upon men. And this has also been a generation that is, throughout their lives, had a tremendous reputation for being a men and women with vision and values. Back in the late 1960s, almost anything written about values in America was about college kids, right? Books
exactly.
Like Greening of America. We lowered the voting age to take advantage of the wisdom of these precious kids. Everything about, apparently older people back then didn't have any values, right? There's values of our college kids. Well, today, almost anything written about values is about people in their 50s. It's culture wars. It's red zone and blue zone. It's all these boomers who are still telling other generations what to do. And again, my point is that certain things age with generations. And the same generation that once trusted no one over 30 today wants to police the morals of everyone under 30. You know, as someone recently told me, the generation that once took recreational drugs to think outside the box now today wants to give their kids drugs to behave inside the box, right? So, you know, you have a certain perverse consistency here with boomers, but they have this reputation for values, and other generations have deferred to that. Look at the culture, how boomers still dominate it. You've got Led Zeppelin, who's still, you got Mick Jagger, who's still at the Super Bowl. You've got Santana still winning awards. And people wonder why today's kids, their music is often just reruns or just, you know, sort of a retreads of booming music. Well, of course it is, because youth generations never compete with midlife generations in their own strength. They always compete with midlife generations and what that generation is weak in. Boomers are weak in the area of community building and teamwork and cooperation and citizenship, but not in the culture. And this is something we've noticed throughout American history, that generations have certain strengths which they carry with them throughout their lives, but society feels very differently when they have that strength in youth as opposed to when they have it as old age. And America will feel very differently with this very culture and values heavy generation in old age than it did when boomers were, you know, screaming 20-somethings at Woodstock.
Why is it then that there seems to be the children of the boomers, they would fall into the X category?
Well, the biological children of boomers would fall into both the two succeeding generations, Xers and millennials.
I seem to perceive some despondency among them just in general.
It depends on the generation. Now, Xers are partly the children of the silent generation and of boomers. They were born 1961 to 1981 is how we define them, basically children of the 60s and 70s. Remember, the boomers were the generation born of increasing indulgence of kids. And Gen X came along, and in our writing, we sometimes have called this 13th generation, America's 13th generation, partly because they're the 13th in a row since the first U.S. generation of Sam Adams and Benjamin Franklin, but also because of the bad luck and ill timing of their life cycle. Think about it. When they came along in the early 1960s, childhood sank to the very bottom of society's priorities. Polls said that staying together for the sake of kids was less important than, you know, living it up and enjoying yourself and living the good life. Schools started not functioning well. Families started breaking up. This is the beginning of the divorce revolution. The indulgence to boomers turned into total underprotection. And it was a time, too, when the whole culture in many ways turned anti-child. I grew up in California then, and I remember these, you know, zero population growth was then a very overtly anti-child movement. And you were frowned on if you brought a child into a restaurant. There were these little stickers that said none is fun and Jesus was an only child and stuff like that. And I will say that the actual fertility rate in America plummeted after 1963. Gen X became known as, and they are, a baby bust generation. Fertility in America reached its all-time low right around the time of Watergate. We finally just literally didn't want to have them. And the culture turned anti-child. I don't know if you recall, this was the 20-year binge of Child as Devil movies. Do you remember those movies?
Oh, yeah.
Mary's Baby, Damien, Omen, It's Alive.
Oh, yeah.
They all had spin-offs and sequels because America could not get enough of the image of the bad, unsocialized, wild child. And that was there. That was the Gen X. That was their initial experience of life. And when they were growing up, that they were raised as free agents. If they had a problem, you give them a latchkey guide, a self-care guide. I was speaking recently in an auditorium full of today's high school students, and I said something about a latchkey guide, a latchkey kids. And they looked at me blankly, and a number of them raised their hand and say, "What's a latchkey kid?"
Oh, boy.
Well, any Gen Xer knows what a latchkey kid is, but today's kids don't know it. These are millennial kids. They have no idea what that is. But my point is that people, employers, will sometimes come to me and say, "How did Gen X get to be the way they are? They find it so hard to commit. They don't trust the system. They assume that no one's in charge. They make short-term deals with individuals, and then they just move on. How did Gen X get to be that way?" And I tell them, it's nothing in the economy. It goes back to their very childhood. It goes back to the mood of this country and how they were treated in their environment when they were growing up as kids, their earliest socialization experiences. And in the 1980s and 90s, when they were, you know, entering adulthood, particularly the 80s, We saw all these reports about how dumb and stupid these kids are. They don't read, they don't vote, they're greedy, and they're materialistic. You remember all the dumping on Gen X?
Oh, yeah.
And their virtues went totally unnoticed. The fact that Gen X is a dynamo in the economy. The productivity of America went down when boomers were entering the labor force, but it's revived with Gen X. And Gen Xers get the job done. They travel light. They respond to the market. They don't complain. They don't ask for government handouts. And after 9/11, when everyone in America talks about the resiliency of America, how many times have you heard people talk about how resilient we Americans are after 9/11? I think they're talking about Generation X.
I think they are, too.
Who was in the Twin Towers at that hour of the morning? Who was on that flight near Pittsburgh? Who was in that wing of the Pentagon? Who was shipping out to Afghanistan 2 weeks later? Yeah. I think the resilience in America comes from this generation of free agents and the way they were raised. And this gets to another point. There is no such thing as a good or bad generation. Every generation is what it has to be. It usually turns out to be the generation we need at the time. And its strengths are just flip sides of its weakness, and its weaknesses are flip sides of its strength. And any strength can be overplayed, and ultimately we get tired of it, and certainly kids get tired of it, which is why new generations move in new directions.
And, if this is psychologically imposed, let me just toss this out there, and if this is way off the track again, just pull me back toward the center stripe a little bit. Peter Townsend, the musician, the guitar player for The Who, wrote an article that I thought expressed it awfully well in, I think it was Q Magazine, one of those. And he said that his parents, you know, that whole generation was the people that we looked up to, slightly older than us.
Right.
He said that his perception of his parents was that, look, we've just been through this really awful war. We are so traumatized. It's not that we don't love you. It's just that we're so traumatized over what we've just been through that we really are we have our hands full just holding on ourselves, let alone helping you hold on. So,
I think that was true for the boomers. The generation that boomers really, that shaped boomers, who were in midlife when boomers were kids, and who certainly, started all the wars that boomer experienced, you know, Westmoreland and LBJ and Dean Rusk, were all of the GI generation. But the generation in charge or not in charge when Xers were kids was the silent. I mean, they were the Bill Cosbys and the Norman Lears, right? They were the guys running Hollywood. They were the people who never made it to the presidency. They were the Watergate Congresses. You see my point? It was the next generation that was taking over by the 70s and 80s. And they the silent generation, precisely because they had been so smothered as kids, raised their own kids in a totally hands-off fashion. You remember Bill Cosby's book about fatherhood, right? If I made 1,000 mistakes, then this next time will be, 1,001. Just kind of making fun of how out of control he was. Well, take a look at their kids. Take a look at these Gen Xers as young parents raising kids, and you will see very protective moms and dads. We have survey data on this that's astonishing. But these Gen Xers now as parents are no-nonsense, raising their kids much more protectively than they themselves were raised. Fascinating story what's happening to Gen X now that they're on the edge of midlife.
So they are, let's see, the Gen Xers now, if my math skills are weak, they're mid-30s now, I guess.
Yeah, well, they'd be from their mid-20s to mid-40s now. They're opening edge. And this generation, you look at the opening cohorts of this generation, born 1961, 62, you're looking at the iconic leaders of Gen X. You're looking at Michael Dell, Michael Jordan, Michael J. Fox, think of all the Michaels, Jodie Foster, Quentin Tarantino, Doug Koopman, who wrote the novel Generation X, Barack Obama, who's the first politician to look at baby boomers as a generation older than his own.
Yeah, he looks kind of young, doesn't he?
Well, he is.
Yes, he is. We're talking with Neil Howe, and we're going to talk to him for a couple of more hours. Please stay with us, because it's going to get much deeper on Coast to Coast AM.